Good morning, brothers and sisters. I'm sorry to disappoint you. Brother Klaus was supposed to be up here this morning, and we got a call. Was it Thursday? Said he came down with a sore throat, losing his voice, didn't think he was going to make it. So if I'm a little scattered, we're going to blame it on that. But I was really enjoying studying into the next section of Matthew chapter 5, and I'm super excited about it this morning. I'm also a little nervous about it and worried about it. It feels a little bit like what the Freedom Fight guys call a double bind, between a rock and a hard place, because Jesus has, it's funny how he does it. He says something very condemning or warning, at least, and very hopeful at the same time. So we're going to read Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 to 20 together. This section has captivated my interest for a long time because what he says here seems to contradict maybe what you could say what Paul says elsewhere. This week I talked to my electricians. Some of them go to the Pensacola Bible Institute and Bible Baptist Church. They believe that Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7 is for the failed kingdom or the future millennial kingdom. The Jews rejected Jesus' kingdom. So these teachings that he gives here are for that covenant, which is not our covenant. And it makes sense when you understand that salvation by grace through faith alone, not of works, clashes here, because Jesus tells us to do a lot of things and he seems to link it to entering the kingdom. And we're going to see that here. So that's a problem. So the way to resolve that problem is to make that divide. Now, I don't agree with that. So I enjoy having conversations about other possible ways to bring the two together, the doctrine of justification by faith and the teachings of Christ that seem to push us to a righteousness that must be done in order to be part of his kingdom. All right, together, Matthew 5:17. Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. Verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say unto you, that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. Let's have a word of prayer. Our Father, which art in heaven, holy is your name. We come to your word this morning, and we want to bow before you in reverence. And we ask that you would pour upon the house of David, whose house Christ has made us, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the spirit of grace and of supplication, that we might look upon the one whom we have pierced and mourn. Mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn, as the prophet Zechariah has prophesied, will happen. May it happen here this morning, Father, as we sit before your word, and as your Son speaks to us. In past days you have spoken unto us by the prophets, but in these days you have spoken to us through your Son. And we want to hear those words and have our hearts transformed by your grace. In Jesus' name, amen. So the title I picked this morning is, Did Jesus believe in rules? And the reason I give it that title is because I have personally been challenged in preaching the words of Jesus with the question of whether or not I believe in the rules. Because I've said some things, controversial things, that can be taken to indicate that rules are a failed enterprise of humanity, and Jesus is a different way to righteousness. And as I came to this passage here this morning, I found it interesting that Jesus seems to stop here between two different sections of the Sermon on the Mount. We have looked at his kingdom manifesto that said, "Who's in my kingdom? What are the four entrance requirements?" Poor in spirit. Mourning. Meek. Hungry for righteousness, right? And I'm going to teach you what? Three things. Mercy. It's right there in chapter 5. You can look. Purity and peacemaking, and for all that you're going to get persecuted. But never mind. Even though you're in a minority and you get persecuted, I say that you are blessed. What? Blessed. That's right. And you are my salt and light. You are my salt and light. As poor and as mourning and as meek and as hungry as you are, entering into my kingdom in that way, letting me put my spirit within you, turning you into a merciful, pure, and peacemaking person, you are my salt and light in this dark world. So let your light shine. Letting your light shine and doing your works before men will what? It'll glorify your Father. And he's going to say a little later, don't do your works to be seen of men, because what? Your reward is here and not there. And God pays no attention to works that you do so that others can see, right? And that's a bit of an enigma. How do I do works? How do I let my light so shine before men that they may see my good works and glorify my daddy versus my works to be seen of men? I believe Jesus is going to dive into a little section here where he's going to he's going to begin to open up that tension, and he's going to help us understand it. So he says, don't think that I have come to destroy the law or the prophets. And why would he raise that question? Apparently this is an accusation, or at least a thought, because Jesus can read thoughts, right? I know what you're thinking. This new kingdom that's poverty, mourning, meekness, and hunger. What about our covenant through Moses, Father Abraham? Who do you think you are? Have you come to just like delete law and prophets? We walked through. Was it four different run-ins that he had with people? Do you remember the four different run-ins that he had over rules? Healing on the Sabbath. Where was that? That was at least one of the places it's recorded is Mark chapter 3, verse 2. And they watched him whether he would heal on the Sabbath day that they might accuse him. And why not? What was wrong with that? What was the rule about that? No going to the doctor on the Sabbath. I'm not sure why. Exactly, I don't remember. There was a reason. Rabbis had spent extensive hours studying the law, talking about theories, and coming up with ways how they could take it to the next level, right? No going to the doctor on the Sabbath day. We're going to watch that upstart prophet. If he comes around here healing on the Sabbath day, we have reason to do away with him. What else did he do? Or maybe his disciples. We'll just lump them all together. That's right. They were walking through the fields, probably rubbing out the grain. It says they were picking the corn, but that was found there in Mark chapter 2, 24. Why do your disciples do on the Sabbath day that which is not lawful? Not lawful. You're lawless, Jesus. We got a problem with that. You're not keeping the rules, right? When they pluck the ears of corn. Two more. There's maybe more, but do you remember any others? They didn't wash their hands. That's recorded several places, including Mark chapter 7. When they saw some of his disciples eat bread with defiled, that is to say, unwashed hands, they found fault. For the Pharisees and all the Jews, except they wash their hands off, eat not, holding the tradition of the elders. And if you want to look at, we could look at Mark chapter 6. It's Jesus goes into a very pointed engagement with them about what's wrong with their hearts. It's just like Isaiah prophesied. You honor me with your lips, but your heart's got a problem that you're not dealing with. And then there was another one. Why do the disciples of John and the Pharisees, remember what that was about? Fast. But your disciples don't fast. So Jesus is addressing this accusation. Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. What's he telling us? Here Jesus clearly states his relationship to everything that has come before, from the mouth of God, through the prophets, through Moses, through the various mediators that he gave him. Because he violated their application, right? They called him lawless. But his response was, I'm not lawless, I what? I fill to the full the law and the prophets, right? What was the law covenant? Well, Paul says the law was a tutor to take an immature child and bring him safely through a period of time until he was grown up, right? Did Jesus teach a cavalier attitude about the law? Well, we'll get to that here in a moment. I would suggest that Jesus, as the lawgiver, he is the lawgiver, right? There shall come a lawgiver, right? He was the lawgiver. He understood the essence of why was the law needed. What are the two options that we exist in tension between in our world? Don't we have God at the top, right? Who do we have at the bottom? Pulling us down. Came to steal, kill, and destroy. We have the devil down here, right? We were created good, living in the light and presence of God. And he came sneaking along and told us a lie, and we took it into our mind and into our heart. And we became corrupted, and we became bound by his chains and became his possession, right? What are the chains? What's the poison that the devil feeds to us? Lies. He feeds us lies, right? So lies came up to us. And then what did to, or I don't know if you put it in our minds, because they weren't corrupted in the garden, right? They didn't have any sin in them. So what did he put in us? Like, what's the nature of the lie?
Doubt.
It's doubt. God, did God really say? And then what did he inject after he had kind of, I'd say he probably tilled the ground with some doubt, right? And then he planted a seed of what? Ye shall be as gods. What's that? Pride, right? I would say that pride is the thing that darkens us. I want to have my way, what I want to do, when I want to do it. I don't care about God, right? Because it's going to be fine, because it's going to make me happy. Right? We crave happiness, and happiness isn't bad. In fact, all of the things that the devil messes up with pride are gifts of God. The devil didn't make anything good. All he did was came to take everything that God made and twist it. And make it look nice and shiny and appealing and something that'll make you happy, but on the backside, spits you out the other side, chewed up, beat up, dead, robbed, blind, destroyed. That's how it works. We just have a hard time, as stupid, blinded humans, we have a hard time seeing that this is the way it goes. And Jesus is very careful to tell us, don't go that path, it leads to hell. We'll get to that soon. But we have a rescue operation, you might say, that came in the form of law. How does law rescue us? How does law rescue you, Fred? Okay, it shows you your need. That's true, right? That you're a little further down the road, maybe, than I was. I'm back here maybe at the beginning. How does the law save you? It functions like a stop sign. You're merrily going down the road chasing your desires. Seth? If you don't have any kind of fence here, you are gonna go down that slippery slope so fast. In fact, let's see, in the Freedom Fight, they picture it as something like this. So you're going along in your selfish path. No consequences, no consequences, no consequences. And about the time the consequences start, you're so far down this slippery slope, you can't climb yourself back up again by yourself, because you're in bondage, you're bound, you're addicted. You can't stop. So the law functions like a fence here. Says, don't go that way. Can you climb over the fence? Can you climb over the fence? You can, right? Whose fault is it if you do? Not the fence's fault, right? It's your fault. You saw the fence, you saw the stop sign. I was walking around the block this morning praying, and I came around the corner, and I looked, and there's the stop sign laying on the ground. And I was like, this is terrible. I got to do something. I tried to stick it in the ground, and it just fell back over again. And I'm like, somebody's not going to know this road. They're going to come flying down this road. They're going to come through the intersection, and pow, they're going to hit somebody else. And it's the guy's fault who knocked it over. But I feel like it's my fault now, because I see it. I need to do something about it. So I called the county, and they said, we'll let the road department know tomorrow, and they'll fix it. I said, tomorrow? Somebody's going to die out here if this doesn't get fixed. Okay, well, we'll see if they'll come out today. Goodbye. And they hung up. The law is a very important rescue operation. It was a very important rescue operation. We need a warning of consequences. Now, did it fix the problem? Did it save us? Why not, Seth? According to Romans chapter 7, I come up to this fence, and I know I shouldn't cross it, but I can't help myself. I climb over anyway, and I go down and do what I shouldn't do. And I sit there, and I say, this is dumb. I look at the law. I know it's spiritual. I know it's good, and I know it's for my good, but but I don't listen to it. I do what I want to do. And the Apostle Paul's final analysis there, by myself, I with the mind serve the law of God, with the flesh the law of sin. I'm this split personality. I was talking to a fellow this week, and he's like, I don't know about all this stuff about surrender your life to Jesus and give your heart to Jesus and give everything to God. Who else is going to pay my bills if I don't work? I can't just like give everything to God. So that started a conversation. And I know a little bit about this guy. He is a good guy. He sacrifices to he volunteers his time in a number of ways. As a neighbor, he's just a great giver. You can't outgive the guy. He's got, I would say, a generous heart, but if you cross him, he won't trust you again, which is understandable. And don't you touch one of his children, or you will suffer for it. He is very protective and loyal to those who are near and dear to him. And thought about that. I said, you know, it's the grace and mercy of God that we even know what goodness is, and we're able to say, I have goodness. That we didn't just totally succumb to the poison and become all 100% evil. We can experience love and loyalty and care, even just the average broken sinner can. And they can do good things for people who do good back for them. We have this capacity to actually do reciprocating good. You can hang out there and focus on that, and you can say, I'm not that bad of a person. But if you really want to be honest with God, you got to look at the other, what is it, 90%? What's the percentage, Seth? All right, we'll take 90. So we talked about that a little bit. And being an honest person, he said, yeah, you're right. I have a whole big section of my life that's about me. And when I serve me, I'm not really serving the ones I love. I'm taking care of me. And I said, that's a brokenness that has you in bondage that you can be free from. You can be. But you can't be free from it by yourself. That's the problem. So, verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Did you hear the story about heaven and earth passing this week? Somebody posted this story about their life passing almost. And some of you heard this, so if you heard this, just bear with me, but it was pretty graphic. Granddad's story. Around lunchtime, they realized that the creek had dropped some. He figured it must have gotten jammed somewhere because it didn't make sense that the creek was going down. Just then, they heard the water coming. A railroad trestle had given way, and a wall of water was coming fast. He tried to get Grandma out the back door and up on the hill, but the water was already knee-high, and she wasn't sure she could make it with her bad leg. The water was waist-high now, so they decided to go upstairs and wait it out. Granddad had the presence of mind to grab some life jackets. After some time, they felt the house shudder and realized they were floating. The house got hung up on their storage building on the far side of the yard and began to fall apart. They were both flung into the water. A railroad beam hit Granddad on the head and pushed him under. He managed to come back, only to get hit again. The next time he came up, he was able to grab hold of a small tree. By then, Grandma was nowhere in sight. After 3 hours, he managed to get someone's attention and was rescued by a helicopter. He is really banged up, and his one eye is completely swelled shut and has a nasty bump on his head, but is in good spirits now that they found Grandma. I heard that story first, and I think this is the same story. I'm going to tell it from Grandma's perspective, which is a little different, which makes sense. Everybody's perspective is a little different, especially when your life's coming apart. Everything's just a blur, right? So Grandma's story was... Grandma's story is testament that miracles do still happen. Soon after they went upstairs, they felt the house shudder and they knew they were afloat. They'd gone about a quarter mile downstream, and the water was still rising in the house. They were standing at the landing at the top of the stairs as they were floating downstream, trying to decide if they should attempt getting on the roof. Just then, the house split apart, throwing Granddad into the water, and he was gone out of sight. Grandma was thrown backwards into her sewing room. She got up and sat in her rocking chair and kept floating downstream. The house continued breaking apart, and Grandma was sure she'd end up in the water any moment. But the sewing room, the bathroom, and the bedroom miraculously stayed together, even though the rest of the house was in pieces. They floated close to a mile farther downstream before running aground on some rocks. The water was still really raging, so Grandma spent the night there in her rocking chair. She was positive she'd never see Granddad again. Morning came, and some people across the creek saw her. They tried to get a helicopter's attention, but it was unable to land due to the water and downed power lines. Four men managed to make their way across the bridge, which was almost impassable, and carried her to safety on her rocking chair. She was flown out by helicopter and personally delivered to Uncle Eric's by the sheriff. By the time they carried her out, it had stopped raining, so Grandma never even got wet. They lost everything except the clothes on their backs, Granddad's wallet, and Grandma's sewing machine and her rocking chair. But that doesn't matter too much now since they have each other. Thanks be to God who answered our prayers. And I guess all that was from Hurricane Helene that came through this week that so nicely spared us, but tragically wreaked devastation on many other people's lives and is again a hard thing to sort through. Why does this good God who comes so patiently coming to us, calling and saying, Adam, where are you? What have you done? Why did you do it? Then say, cursed is the earth that you live in. Well, as Paul looks at this world, he says, creation is groaning in travail. It has been subject to vanity, not willingly. None of us will like this. I don't know. I kind of like to see a hurricane a little bit. There's just that little part of me, so I'll be honest about that. My neighbor said, Josh, you're crazy. I said, I don't know. It's just the love of adventure, I guess. But we don't like it when the travail of this broken creation devastates us. But Paul said, we weren't subjected to it willingly, but for the purpose of hope, right? And as Jesus looks at us here, he says, I tell you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. When God says something, his word is forever, because he is forever. And he will not pass away. You can count on it. Until heaven and earth pass, God's words won't pass. Don't. You can hang your life upon the words of God. And then he says something interesting as well. Till all be fulfilled. And that little phrase, again, reminds us of what he said before. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. And if you go a little further in the book of Matthew, I think it's chapter 11, John was struggling with his faith. Jesus, are you really the Messiah? And then Jesus turns to all the unbelievers who didn't listen to John's message and says, what did you go out there in the wilderness to see? A reed shaken with the wind? Somebody in fine clothes? Like, what were you looking for? That you didn't see what God was doing he said the law and the prophets were until John, but since that time the kingdom of heaven is preached. The kingdom of heaven suffers violence and the violent take it by force. All right, there's another enigma phrase, right? But he's saying some things have come to fulfillment. The old wine bottles are about to be set aside, and the new wine's going to be put in new bottles, right? So we see in the plan of God, even though the words of God never fail, the words of God are spoken to a certain people for a specific time to accomplish a specific purpose. And Brother Fred beat me to the punchline, which was, The purpose of the law is to show us what? We're needy. We got a problem. We're sinners. Josh plus law does not equal goodness. Unfortunately. I mean, it has saved me from a lot of heartache to say that, but it didn't actually fix me, right? And that's the problem Paul's dealing with in Romans 7. And so Jesus knows that while he has come to set aside what's been fulfilled, if you will, what he's going to do is he's going to target something very painful and personal. And in the Bible study this week, one of the guys said, hey, it's a good thing we're not under that old covenant of law. Now we're under grace. That's a lot easier. And I said, what? The law said, do and live. And Jesus came along with the message of grace and said, die and live. But now, I don't know about you, but to me, I'd rather do rather than die. I'd rather just, you know, have this thing where I can still live and make God happy and make me happy and kind of figure out a path forward. But Jesus is set on taking us through a death into a life that releases us from the stranglehold of the lies of the serpent and the pride that has infected our soul. And he is going to fulfill the law, and he's going to deliver to us the fulfillment of the prophet's promise. I will come and take out your stony heart and give you a new heart of flesh. So there's two things that Jesus addresses that we as divided-hearted humans do. We have two problems. These are the two points. Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. What's our problem there? Because of our sin-sickened heart, what do? To God's truth, to his character, to his will, to his words, to his mission for our life, what do to it as sin-sickened humans? We minimize it. Break the least, right? Well, okay, maybe normally that's wrong, but for me in this situation, it's okay. We just make this tiny little space for pride. No, we're not going to go all the way over the edge. That would obviously be sinful. But I need just this little bit for me, right? I'm just going to break the least commandments. I'm just going to save a little room for me, right? Isn't that at the core of our stupid selfishness? We want to bargain with God. I want to acknowledge you're God, but I still want to have some of me. And so what we do when we bump up against the commandments of God is we say, I know better. And we're trapped with the same problem, right? What's the poison that's infected us? What's the lie that's captured us? Pride. Be like God. Be your own boss. You know better. You don't have to do this. It doesn't really apply to you. And so Jesus said, be aware of this essential problem as we go forward into discovering the beautiful mind and will and heart of God, that you don't say to yourself, I'm going to mostly do it, but not all the way, right? Whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. That one of the things that stood out to me as I thought about that is, we like to use words to tell people what to do. And it can make a difference. Words are amazing things. But it's the things we do that actually impact people the most. Because they subconsciously see us and they say, oh, I could do that too. Right? So when you do, you teach. You may not be a teacher in word, but just by the fact of doing, we are teachers. And whosoever shall do and teach, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. So, point number one, our pride problem leads us to minimize God's words. Problem number two, for I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. And I'm going to say again, this is a pride problem, but it's a different pride problem. What is this pride problem? The Pharisees were pretty amazing, actually. They say they were well respected by the people of their day. They were so well respected that even though they were in a minority, they were able to exercise control over the common people. And you see at times Jesus playing with that numbers, small versus big. But how they were able to exercise that control was by the fact that they had created an image that they did know better than the average person. They knew better than the average person. They were more holy than the average person. They kept all the little tiny rules better than the average person, right? Now, which is worse? Minimizing the rules or keeping the rules better than the average person? Did Jesus indicate that there's a difference? He did. If you break a least commandment, what happens to you? You're least in the kingdom. What if you do better than average your own way? And the you shall in no what? You shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. Now, I don't know about you, but that puts me right back on my heels. No, it doesn't put me on my heels. It puts me flat on my face saying, God, I need your help, because I think I'm a little better than average. And if I've got that pride, I'm not even in the kingdom. The guy who's fudging the rules for selfish purposes, he's at least got a chance, even though it's going to impact his eternal destiny and the responsibility that God trusts him with, because he withheld trust and surrender from God. But unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. And I guess that's why, as you read the rest of this testament, I found twice as many scriptures speaking negatively about the law as I did speaking positively about the law. And that's kind of shocking. Can you think of scriptures that are positive about the law off the top of your head? From the New Covenant, particularly, New Testament. Romans 7, Ed, can you give me one? Yeah.
The law came in that sin might become exceedingly sinful.
I think that was a little earlier, maybe, but fits. So, The law came to point out the problem, right? Fence, that's bad, this is good. We needed that stop sign. And we needed that sense of, I got a problem deep in here. He says, not only did the law show me what sin was, the law also, he says in there, the law is good, but I am carnal. The law is spiritual, he says there in Romans chapter 7. That's a little funny, because you think of the law versus letter versus spirit that he talks about elsewhere. He just actually just said it in the first part of Romans 7. We're not in 6 and 7. We're not under the law, and we have become dead to the law. We no longer serve in the oldness of the letter, but in the newness of the Spirit, right? And if you go on through Romans 7, he says a lot of other things, that the thing that was meant for me to be good actually stirs up my desires. The law came along. I was alive without the law once, and then the law came. And sin revived, and I died. And he says, what was meant to me for good actually ended up stirring all of the desires. All you got to do is walk down the road and see a sign that says, wet paint, don't touch. And what does every 8-year-old do? Touch it, right? What is that? Thou shalt not covet. He said, got me. According to Philippians chapter 3, he said, I was of the tribe of Benjamin, Pharisee of the Pharisees. Concerning the righteousness which is in the law, I was blameless. Right? And he says later, so he could do that. In some way, he could achieve this standard where he was esteemed among his equals. I think he says that in Galatians. Among my peers, I was considered it. More righteous than everybody else. But he said, I got to that thing that said, thou shalt not covet, and I knew I wasn't free from covetousness. I was able to check all the boxes, and I was able to keep a good image, and I was able to offer the right sacrifices when I did mess up, but I couldn't get rid of this. I couldn't get rid of this black heart that kept coveting, and I wanted it to stop, and I couldn't stop it. Oh, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from the body of this death? And he goes on, and Paul's probably the most vocal in his epistles. We're not going to go into them, but he's probably the most vocal as he talks about this problem of mine own righteousness, which is of the law, which he eventually says, I have counted a liability, and I count it dung, because I see what Jesus is saying here, that mine own righteousness, which feeds pride and comes from pride, me taking the law of God and turning it into, I can do better even, and using that as sort of this thing to protect my ego, my image, was actually destroying me. Now, I did it honestly, but I wasn't doing it in faith. And he says, when you seek the righteousness which is of God by faith, you find Jesus. And when you find Jesus, then you say, I'm willing to get rid of all that to know him, to be in fellowship with him, and to be conformed to him, even to death. That's where it leads. Because when you see his cross lifted up and you see the price he paid, you see the love rescue, and that's what Jesus is going to bring to us. Instead of law, we now have a cross. And up here in the holiness of God, you also have love, amazingly, self-sacrifice. I asked my wife on the way to church, what's the opposite of pride? What's the opposite of pride? That's a simple answer. Humility, right? So, did we put humility up here? Is God humble? To Ed, is God humble?
Yes.
He is?
He thinks rightly of himself.
Oh, he thinks rightly of himself. He has a proper view of himself, which is humility, right? Is he ashamed of his sins?
Is he ashamed of what?
His sins.
Sins?
Right. Is he brought low because of his needs?
Oh.
Is he ever humiliated?
No,
he's not like us in that way, right? So I would say probably a better word for the opposite of pride would be, when you're thinking about God, would be love and self-sacrifice. And I would say that as you walk forward in the death with Jesus, Paul said the people that want to appear exceedingly righteous, they treat the body harshly, or they observe certain things really carefully. But those things actually don't put the pride self to death. It doesn't actually solve the problem. It has a wisdom according to this world. Everybody looks at them and says, wow, that's an amazing guy. He gave all his money away. He went to the stake. He can speak with the tongues of men and angels. He's got all this amazing spirituality. And Paul says, but if you don't have love,
if you don't actually have love and self-sacrifice, which produced the cross, which is your rescue,
if you're not carrying that story forward, you are a zero. If ultimately your religious experience makes you happy that you're better than other people instead of making you a self-sacrificing savior, you haven't got the message of Jesus. And that's basically where he started, right? You've got to come broken, recognizing your need and hungry, and I'll teach you mercy. What's mercy? Mercy is not saying, ha ha, you did wrong, you got what you deserved, you're just going to have to sit in your vomit for a while. Right? No, that's not mercy. Mercy says, I know what you're going through because I have been there and I still suffer from the same sickness you have. Let me help wash you up and restore you in the spirit of meekness, considering my own self, right? That's what Jesus came to teach us. And it costs us to show mercy. The cross cost him incredibly. There's not really any reference to the cross in here, but once you figure out what the cross is, it's all over in Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7, right? It's amazing. It's amazing. So Jesus is going to just shake us around a little bit, and he's going to say, if you're not better than the Pharisees, you're not in. And if you're minimizing my truth, it's going to cost you dearly in the kingdom. So I need you to sit up and pay attention. I'm going to walk you through this heart change process, and that's where we're going to go. He's going to show us the difference between let your light so shine that they may see your good works and glorify your Father, and he's going to contrast it with do not do your works before men to be seen of them, for you have your reward. There's one more interesting little point in chapter 7. Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7 are laid up as a bit of a mirror, and there's a center that's of primary importance. We don't have time to talk about that this morning, but one of the things he says later that gave me just as much pause as I am not come to destroy but to fulfill is where he says in chapter 7, therefore, all things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them. For this is the law and the prophets. And I said to myself, that's like saying the highest order is to do for people what I selfishly want done for me. Now, how could Jesus say that? But I think if we're honest about that, I came home from a Bible study and I told my wife Friday morning several years ago, I am so excited about the kingdom of heaven. I can't wait to see what's next. And my phone rang. And it was a guy saying, I need some money. I need some food. Just like that. And I'm like, he said Vernon gave him my number, but it feels awful coincidental right now. And what I wasn't prepared for in that relationship was when he said, at one point, he was diabetic too. He said, Josh, I need you to go buy me a case of soda. I'm thirsty. And I'm like, a case of soda? You don't need a case of soda any more than you need poison right now. And I'm sitting there drinking down my 48-ounce Polar Pop from Circle K. And God's like, what kind of hypocrite are you? You think it's any better for you than it is for him, right? Do ye even so to others, even as you would that they would do to you? God has this amazing way of revealing to us our stupid selfishness that we justify day in and day out when we start doing mercy. It's astonishing. But Jesus knows exactly what to put his finger on and where to call us to account. And I've fumbled many relationships, and I'm just grateful that I have one promise. Jesus said, if you'll let my words abide in you, you will be fruitful. My words will prune you. My words will make you fruitful. my words will not pass away, though heaven and earth pass away, though a hurricane destroys you, though some evil guy comes and asks you for everything and you have to listen to him and give, just like I said, because he asked you, or whatever that means. Go figure that one out. This world's passing away, brothers and sisters. And if we're going to be freed from the poison, the only antidote is not, I can try harder, do better. No, it's not going to work. Oh, I've got a new technique. No, it's not going to work. The words of Jesus Christ set us free. If we'll, like James says, receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save your soul. Let's come to the Lord in prayer.